I'm Abigail Galvan. Welcome to EWTN Pro-Life Weekly.
It's really how that role and responsibility is taken up by that particular minister.
Concerns of protections for disabled persons in Canada after major changes in the Prime Minister's cabinet.
Two of the people actually left the country. They were so distraught by being offered such a deplorable thing.
A retired Canadian Army veteran shares the startling stories of combat veterans who say they were offered assisted suicide instead of mental health care.
We do have a crisis in this country. Our maternal mortality is the worst in the developed world, and that is abhorrent.
And a rise in maternal mortality rates, analysis on a recently released study.
I would like that our first great desire be for a united church.
The inaugural Mass of Pope Leo XIV. The Holy Father called for unity within the church, peace among nations, and condemned the exploitation of the poor. Just 2 days prior, Pope Leo reaffirmed church teaching on life. In a meeting with ambassadors, he maintained that family is based on a union between a man and a woman and declared the inherent dignity of the unborn. In attendance at the inaugural Mass on Sunday were many heads of state, royalty and religious leaders, including Vice President and Catholic J.D. Vance and his wife, Usha, U.S. Secretary of State and Catholic Marco Rubio, and newly elected Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, who considers himself a devout Catholic. Carney is already facing criticism in Canada for reworking and renaming his cabinet. He cut the number of ministers from 39 to 29, consolidated their positions, and changed the titles of their offices. The title of Ministry of Diversity, Inclusion, and Persons with Disabilities has been eliminated, sparking outcry from some disability advocates, among others. That position is now under the Minister of Jobs and Families. We reached out to Prime Minister Mark Carney's office about these changes, and they responded, saying in part that in the current cabinet, Minister Hajdu leads the work to support Canadians living with disabilities, including our commitment to reviewing and reforming the process to apply for the disability tax credit and develop a disability justice framework to address longstanding inequities, biases, and systemic discrimination. Amanda Achman, creator of Dying to Meet You, a project that aims to help our society understand the value of human life at all stages, joins us now to talk about these changes in Canada's Parliament. Amanda, why is it important to have the minister's title include the words persons with disabilities? And how do you feel about the response the ministry gave about the changes they made?
First of all, I would like to thank you for your interest in this, because what persons with disabilities across Canada are wondering now is whether they are a priority of the federal government. And so it may be natural for a new government to shift the priorities and the cabinet positions, but what we see now is that we have a minister responsible for artificial intelligence, all the while the ministry responsible for persons with disabilities has been removed or shifted. And so this is causing communities, organizations, persons with disabilities to question what message is intended to be sent by this change. Does it mean that there is less of a priority on the part of the government? And that's the real question here.
And assisted suicide in Canada continues to grow, and persons with disabilities have voiced concern that they will be targeted by these laws. What are you seeing on the ground there in Ottawa?
It is a tragedy that the main conversation about persons with disabilities that Canadians have been privy to over recent years has to do with them being eligible for euthanasia. And so even when we had a minister for disability, and this is where there's some important scrutiny as well, even with a minister for disability, these ministers previously supported both the initial ushering in of nationwide euthanasia as of 2016, and in 2021, the disability minister voted in favor of the further expansion of euthanasia, so-called medical assistance in dying, to include persons with disabilities whose deaths are not reasonably foreseeable. This has led some disability rights advocates to describe Canada making disabled people into a killable class, because if you have a disability and are not at end of life, you can ask for state-provided euthanasia in Canada. And that message is that those with disabilities have lives that are perhaps less worth living. This is extremely alarming. This undercuts Canada's pride as being an inclusive, tolerant, diverse society where everyone belongs and has a role to play. And so it's not only a matter of having a minister responsible for disability, but it's really how that role and responsibility is taken up by that particular minister. So it's not enough to have someone with the title. We need someone who recognizes and affirms that every person, regardless of ability or disability, absolutely belongs in our country, has a role to play, and has a life worth living.
And quickly, what resources do those with disabilities need instead of being offered MAID?
One thing that I'm aware of is that many of the government programs for persons with disabilities are vastly undersubscribed, partly due to them being complicated and convoluted. And so certain tax credits and other programs have so much paperwork and so many complications just to be eligible for them. And so some people with disabilities have told me euthanasia is the only thing the government is telling me I'm really qualifying for. And this is outrageous. And so while there are programs and while there are initiatives, if there continue to be barriers and roadblocks to accessibility of government programs, that's also not good enough. And so the role of a disability minister was supposed to be for the disability community to know who their point person is in Parliament, in government, to whom they could raise these concerns and address these gaps. And now it's going to be the role and responsibility of community organizations, the church, and families to look out for those in their lives who may need their support due to these gaps.
Amanda, thank you for your work, and please count on our prayers.
Thank you.
Assisted suicide in Canada is prolific. In 2023 alone, more than 15,000 people died by medical assistance in dying, accounting for 4.7% of all deaths in Canada that year. Legalized in Canada in 2016 for those whose death was reasonably foreseeable, it was expanded in 2021 to those whose death was not reasonably foreseeable. A proposal to offer MAID to those with mental illness has been postponed to 2027 after a large outcry against the measure. There are increasing reports that veterans in Canada are being offered assisted suicide when they reach out for mental health help. The Toronto Sun reported most recently that a two-tour Afghanistan combat veteran was offered medically assisted suicide by a Veterans Affairs caseworker. Mark Minka, a Canadian Army veteran, now podcaster, joins us now to talk about these disturbing stories that he has heard firsthand. Mark, how many veterans in Canada have told you that they've been offered assisted suicide instead of actual mental health assistance?
The number keeps growing. Thanks for having me on very much. So the number keeps growing. The original story by the Government of Canada was that it was just one veteran, one time, with one veteran service agent making the offer. But we've found out that that is simply not true. Over the last few years, I've had on my show, and this is just me alone, I have no crew, it's just a one-man show, and I've had three different veterans testifying, being whistleblowers, if you will, on my show. So if I'm able to find three, goodness only knows how many we actually have.
Yes, and these men and women put their lives on the line for their country, the very country that now seems to turn its back on them by even suggesting assisted suicide. What is the reaction these veterans are sharing with you?
Well, for the people that were actually made, who actually received this offer, it's been absolutely gutting. Two of the people actually left the country. They were so distraught by being offered such a deplorable thing. And the overwhelming sense of betrayal, it's a moral injury. It's what they call sanctuary trauma, where the place you go for help is the place that betrays you and causes harm. So it's absolutely gutting.
And can you speak to the help these veterans actually need that they aren't getting?
Well, that's one of the challenges. What the system is doing right now is not offering a lot. my show, I've got about 340 episodes all on healing modalities that I find all around the world. I've never got a call from Veterans Canada saying, hey, what have you found? What works? So they just give you the bare basics. It's talk therapy or pills. Pick one. And when the efficacy rate of that is only 12 to 16% at best, that leaves a pretty darn big gap. So they don't know where to go or what to do. And in lieu of actual help, they're offering death because they don't know what else to do. But they're not looking either.
And Mark, you yourself are a veteran and have experience in that. What could our viewers do to help support more veterans?
Well, have an open and honest conversation. Don't fall for the stigma such as, oh, if a veteran has PTSD, they must be violent and dangerous. Nothing could be further from the truth. If somebody's suffering from PTSD, they are a danger to themselves occasionally, if they've gone so far as to be suicidal. But just compassion, open conversations, and encourage them to reach out for help. Any help that you go forward with is better than no help at all. And again, that's why I have my show.
That's incredible. And from what you've seen, you've had your show for a while. You mentioned several episodes. What has been most effective?
Well, there's a guy in Chicago, Dr. Eugene Lipov, who offers stellate ganglion block, dual sympathetic stellate ganglion block therapy mixed with ketamine and talk therapy. Puts it all together. And he's out of Chicago, and that is the best one that I've found with the best results. Canadian Special Forces go from Canada down to Chicago to get this treatment.
And quickly, before we let you go, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just that the resources are out there. I know they are not available through Veterans Affairs either in the States or in Canada, but the resources are out there. There are so many little mom-and-pop operations that help so much. Everything from equine therapy, things that are accessible like that, to psychedelics and everything in between. So don't think that it's hopeless. It is not.
Mark, thank you for your service to your country and for all that you're doing now to help veterans.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, more countries are seeking to legalize medical aid in dying, like in Scotland, where a bill just passed its first vote. Supporters claim fear and suffering give a person a so-called right to end their lives. The law would allow people with a terminal illness to request medical aid to end their life if they have been ruled mentally fit to make the decision by two doctors. Those against the bill say it's a Pandora's box.
The risks are not theoretical. They are real, and they fall most heavily, as I have said already, on those who are already the most vulnerable. Once the bill leaves our hands, its meaning and consequences will be shaped by others. And once the law accepts the principle that some lives are no longer worth living, the pressure will begin, not from Parliament necessarily, but through legal precedent and public expectation to make the law more inclusive and more flexible.
The bill needs to clear two more phases of scrutiny in Parliament before it becomes law. In England and Wales, a bill to allow terminally ill adults expected to die within 6 months to ask to end their life already passed its first stage in the House of Commons last November. Since then, dozens of amendments have been added, some of which were debated on last Friday. Opponents say the bill say stronger protections for the most vulnerable are needed, and some said the country should focus on improving end-of-life care rather than assisted dying.
The evidence is clear that palliative care does not get better when you introduce assisted dying. We saw that in the Bill Committee, and we absolutely should be looking to address palliative care because that will benefit more people.
The bill will return for further debate on June 13th. The bill has sparked backlash from the Royal College of Psychiatrists. They say they cannot support the bill in its current form. A few changes they urge members of Parliament to make to the bill is to ensure safeguards for people with mental illness, allow for doctors and other professionals to remove themselves from the process should they have conscientious objections. They also want a requirement for assessment of unmet needs that are treatable. For example, a person with intolerable pain or inadequate housing may want to die, but those needs, once met, can change a person's mind. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has ordered a review of the regulation and labeling of the abortion pill mifepristone. It comes after a new study by the Ethics and Public Policy Center, or the EPPC, found nearly 11% of women who use the deadly drug suffer a serious adverse event. That is 22 times more frequent than the FDA currently recognizes. The EPPC also found that the failure rate of the abortion pill is double what was previously reported.
It also shows that it's ineffective. So in about 1 in 20 cases, the abortion pill does not actually result in a complete abortion. So the woman ends up either taking the pill again, which is not recommended by the FDA at any point, or she ends up undergoing a surgical abortion to complete the abortion.
The EPPC is now urging the FDA to reconsider approval of the abortion pill altogether. But if the drug does remain available, the EPP says the FDA should mandate full reporting of its side effects and reinstate earlier safety protocols, including mandating in-person doctor visits before the deadly drug is prescribed and reducing the window a woman can take the pill. Maternal mortality in the U.S. is on the rise, according to new research. A study published in JAMA Network Open found pregnancy-related deaths rose nearly 28% from 2018 to 2022. The study analyzed deaths up to a year postpartum. Almost one-third of the deaths took place after 6 weeks of childbirth.
The sort of the image that we have where women are delivering their babies, they're in the hospital, they're in a birth center, and they die in childbirth. It does happen, but maternal mortality itself is calculated under a much broader set of criteria for determining how and when a mother died.
Researchers found that cardiovascular disease, cancer, mental disorders, and drug and alcohol-induced deaths were the leading causes of late maternal deaths. Dr. Ingrid Skop with the Charlotte Lozier Institute joins us now to share her thoughts on this study. Dr. Skop, if these deaths are related to cancer or alcohol abuse, why do researchers link them to pregnancy and those who have recently given birth?
So a pregnancy-related death is defined as caused by the pregnancy itself or exacerbated by the pregnancy or its treatment. So in the case of cancer, perhaps those evaluating the death thought that the treatment might have been different because she was pregnant, or in the case of a mental health death, they may have discovered the answer to the question, was she depressed or despondent perhaps because of an adverse outcome, an induced abortion or a stillbirth? The question that's answered is, if she had not been pregnant, would she still have died? The good news is we're seeing deaths related to catastrophic events at the time of childbirth going down. So sepsis, hypertension, hemorrhage, thrombotic events. Doctors and hospitals are getting much better at caring for women with emergencies at childbirth. We have protocols, we have training drills. The bad news is deaths related to chronic illness, deaths related to advanced maternal age, and deaths related to mental health causes are going up. Also, in regarding this study, COVID-19 pandemic affected women severely. So there were many deaths related to that, and I think that's reflected as well.
And what is the time period after giving birth the doctors recommend coming in for a checkup? And has this timing changed recently?
Traditionally, we would bring a woman in about 2 weeks after a cesarean, about 6 weeks after a normal delivery. But recognizing that so many deaths are occurring after childbirth, for example, if a woman has hypertension, we may bring her in just a few days or a week for an exam. And also, we're much more aware of mental health issues. And so if we have concerns about a woman, we'll bring her in earlier to evaluate her mental health as well.
What do you think can be done to prevent these deaths?
Well, I think we need awareness of what the crisis really is. We do have a crisis in this country. Our maternal mortality is the worst in the developed world, and that is abhorrent. But again, we need to be educating women about having their children at a younger age. Women who wait until they're 40 or 45, have established their careers, they're going to be more at risk. We need to be helping the population become more healthy before pregnancy occurs, decreasing those chronic illnesses that put women at risk. We need to really be thinking hard about why do we have such a mental health crisis and how can we help women. And really, the racial disparities are quite concerning. But one thing that we see is that the groups that are most affected by maternal mortality have the highest rates of single moms living in poverty, often affected by chronic illnesses, but also by family breakdown. So I think this is something that is not discussed enough. How can we prioritize the health of a family so that women are not as likely to live alone in poverty? And if they should become ill, that they have a social support network that can help them, get them into the doctor so that they get care in a timely manner.
I think all these social issues that you've mentioned are very important. And I think right now there's an opportunity in the pro-life movement to kind of address some of these. And in your perspective, what role would maybe nonprofits, apostolates, the church, and maybe even the government have to play in this to walk alongside doctors and these mothers who may be struggling with mental health, who might be single mothers and may be struggling with poverty?
Yeah, excellent question. So there are so many organizations working on this, and I do give them credit for the great work that they're doing. The government, of course, you know, providing Medicaid for a full year postpartum so that a woman does not lose her health insurance. That's very important for women with chronic illnesses, because, again, we saw many of those women get sick and sometimes die beyond 6 weeks, because in many cases we count pregnancy mortality up to a year after the end of the pregnancy. But I work very closely with pregnancy centers, and they offer counseling for mental illness. They offer support for families. They help women to discover the resources that they need. And this is critically important. So the government has a role, but I believe that nonprofits do have a role in support, and the church needs to be aware of this issue. We need to be speaking out about the things that are in our ballpark, which is morality according to what the Bible says, and the family as the root of society, as Pope Leo just mentioned. This is critically important. I believe if we did not have such a devastating family breakdown in so many of our communities, that we would see maternal mortality improve dramatically in those communities.
Well, Dr. Scott, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for that call to action and for just giving us such a insight into this very complicated landscape.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you.
Coming up, pro-life and pro-abortion legal cases across the U.S. We bring you the wins and losses for protecting the lives of the pre-born when we return.
This year, I was proud to sign a constitutional amendment to enshrine the protections of Roe v. Wade into the Maryland State Constitution. And now we write the next chapter in our work to protect and defend basic health care rights.
Maryland will become the first state to use money collected from a surcharge on insurance plans sold under the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare to fund a program to pay for abortions. Democratic Governor of Maryland, Wes Moore, signed the bill into law on Tuesday, May 13th. The law will make roughly $25 million available to pay for abortions in Maryland when it takes effect on July 1st. A Michigan judge has struck down pro-life protections in the state, claiming that they conflict with an amendment that enshrined so-called abortion rights in the state constitution in 2022. The overturned law included a 24-hour waiting period before an abortion, informed consent requirements, and restrictions on non-physicians performing abortions. The judge claims the waiting period, quote, exacerbates the burdens that patients experience seeking abortion care, unquote. Abortion is currently legal in Michigan up to the point of fetal viability, which is around 24 weeks. The heartbeat law remains in place in South Carolina thanks to the state Supreme Court, who agreed that a preborn baby's heartbeat begins at 6 weeks. It comes after Planned Parenthood challenged the law to extend the window a woman could get an abortion to 9 weeks. The High Court unanimously ruled that while South Carolina's legal definition of a fetal heartbeat was not clear, supporters and opponents of the law that all seem to think it banned abortion after 6 weeks. South Carolina is one of three states, including Georgia and Florida, that protect life at 6 weeks gestation. And in Kentucky, state officials and legislators joined other pro-life leaders in the Capitol Rotunda to sign a maternal health measure into law. The House Bill 90 establishes freestanding birthing centers in Kentucky, expands mental health support for mothers, and clarifies when a doctor can provide emergency care during pregnancy. Abortion is currently banned in Kentucky except to save the life of the mother. State Representative Jason Nemes, the bill's primary sponsor, says clarifying the state's pro-life law helps save lives.
And the primary reason was to protect the life of the mother when she's presenting. She's pregnant, she's at the hospital, and she needs care. And I think it will save Kentucky mothers.
That does it for this edition of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Be sure to like and follow us on our social media channels. You can find us at EWTN Pro-Life on X, Facebook, and Instagram. And sign up for our newsletter, The Pro-Life Pulse, EWTN.com/pro-life. Remember, life is a gift. Your life is a gift. God bless.